This spoiler-filled podcast is recorded live, unscripted, and intended for those over 18. Now prepare your ears for the audio stimulation they've been waiting for all day as we step into
the spoiler room.
And this is another edition of the Spoiler Room, a special series we are doing for 2015. I got this wonderful inspiration from covering Tremors that, hey, there's other films celebrating 25th anniversaries, so why not bring them into focus and talk about them, because there's some really great ones out there, especially from 1990. And since this is the month of love, February, we're going to talk today about Nightbreed and Frankenhooker, two obscure romance films, you could almost call them. And tonight in the room with me, I have a great crew here with us. First off, we have Mr. Cole Meredith back. How are you doing, sir, tonight?
I am terrific. I'm fresh from seeing Frankenhooker for the first time. Literally, since Mom credits rolled. So
he just had his fresh. I'm ready. He just has Harry Pop by Frankenhooker.
Yes.
Nice.
And then in the room, of course, is our diva of the spoiler room. As always, a pleasure, Miss Dawn. How are you tonight, Dawn?
Pretty good. This is my kind of Valentine's romance movies.
These are the films that Dawn really likes to watch during Valentine's Day.
Absolutely.
And that's right. And we have Gonzorific back with us, Mr. Andrew Shearer. Always a pleasure, sir. Hello.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for having me on the show.
Always great to have you here. And then there is the Bowtie Man himself, Paul. How are you tonight?
Doing well. I got a special bow tie today. This is my Batman bow tie because of Danny Elfman.
Oh, nice call. Yes. Danny is involved in our conversation this evening. He's not here, but we'll talk about him. I wish he was here. and last but definitely not least, Moviocrity is here representing Scott Davis. How are you tonight?
Sup? Doing pretty good. I knew that we were going to be talking about Frankenhooker. That's why the coffee I'm drinking tonight is chock full of nuts.
Oh, wow. Well, before we get to Frankenhooker, we're going to talk about Nightbreed. Came out 1990, celebrating its 25th anniversary, directed and written by Clive Barker, based off of his novel. According to IMDb, it talks about a troubled man who is drawn into a mythical place called Midian, where a variety of monsters are hiding from humanity. That's really a simple way to put it. there's actually a lot more going on with this film. So let's start right away with just Nightbreed, general impressions. Now, the one that I got to see recently, there's lots of different cuts out there. There's a theatrical cut. The one on Netflix Instant right now is the director's cut. So tonight, let's start off by just asking our crew here what they initially thought of Nightbreed when they saw it. And first we'll start off with Cole. Sir, Nightbreed, how'd you feel about it when you first saw it?
When I first saw it, I was really young and an avid Fangoria reader. And I was actually in a movie. It was my first experience in being in film, so you know, I was with the Fangoria articles about its troubled production, and then knowing that I wasn't going to be seeing really a complete movie, and having been acting in a movie while we watched it, it was a kind of a unique experience. And at the time, I was disappointed. Although I went back and revisited the movie all as I grew up and as I got older, and you know, I wore my VHS tape out watching it, but I always never invested too much in it because I always knew it was an incomplete movie. It wasn't the movie that was meant to be seen. So I just would always keep my opinions kind of muted. I wouldn't get too passionate about it. But a week ago, I just saw the copy on Netflix Instant.
The director's cut.
And I hadn't seen the theatrical cut in about 2 years. So you know, my opinion was it was a clean slate going into it. And at this point, I think it's a masterpiece. It's probably one of the only films that could fit into, like, the Tim Burton category easy, because it has such a love for villains and such a sort of distaste for anything human. I really enjoy the film, but my initial reaction was not a good one. Although having the recut, the problems with the original are still in the recut, in that mm-hmm. it jumps into the plot seemingly, it's almost like you're watching a sequel in a way. Midian is, it's really almost like Army of Darkness in terms of, if you hadn't seen Evil Dead 2, it feels like you're just thrown into this Midian world. If you hadn't seen the opening credits, you would have no explanation or no... it just moves way too fast at opening act. And that remains in all the cuts that I've seen. But I love the film. I really do. It's one of a kind. It's a masterpiece. And I don't mean that because it's perfect. It's just... it's a masterpiece of a film. And especially this new cut I saw, which especially emphasizes the love story a bit more. I really like it. Mm-hmm.
I will definitely say that the director's cut emphasizes the love story. Don, what about you? Your impressions with the theatrical and the director's cut?
Well, my first impression of the film itself is obviously the... Just an almost visceral reaction to the stunning makeup and practical effects. Mm-hmm. I think that and the cinematography are just, they set up the world for you and in create a world that's so vivid and nightmarish and full of mystique and wonder that you want to be a part of it. Mm-hmm. And that's through both movies. I agree in the director's cut as compared to the theatrical version, there's far more emphasis on the love story and it carries throughout. I just wish that there was more chemistry between Craig Schiffer and Anne Bobby.
There really isn't a whole lot. You don't really feel a lot of passion there between them.
It seems
a little bit more cookie cutter.
I mean, they're both very talented. They both do their jobs, but their scenes together kind of, they go through the motions.
That they do. Andrew, what about you? Your first impressions when you first saw this film?
Oh, dude, I was nuts for Nightbreed. I couldn't wait. I'd been reading Clive Barker at that point. I was about 13 years old. I'd been reading him since I was like 9. And so I was, I'd done a book report on Cabal, the novel that Nightbreed was based on. And I like drew, I wish I still had it. I actually dug out my journal from 1990 to see if my review of it was in here. But the journal starts in August 1990, so I do talk about the struggles of renting it, but I did get to see it in the theater, and I clipped the ad. I was going crazy over it, man. I was a kid who loved monsters, and Clive Barker's a guy who loves monsters, and Nightbreed's a movie for people that love monsters, and I was just like Don said, man. I was just bowled over by all those great creature effects and stuff. I remember thinking, being disappointed how they'd changed the ending and stuff, or rather didn't have the ending or things mm-hmm. but I knew that books and movies were two separate things and I enjoyed them both on their own merit, but to be able to see that stuff, you gotta remember, not a whole lot of movies have been made of Clive Barker's fantasy writing because he is just, he is mm-hmm. out there. And it'd be one thing if he wrote like Lord of the Rings type stuff, but his monsters are all fucking and stuff. So that's just not a thing that the world probably will ever be ready for in terms of the people have a lot of money to spend on making films. But I loved it. I was absolutely in love with Nightbreed.
Awesome. And Paul, what about you, sir?
I didn't appreciate it until I was actually an adult because I mm-hmm. never really understood the subtext of the persecution until I actually got to be old enough to understand what that meant. I don't think this was one of my favorite Clive Barker movies, but it is a great film, and I love the director's cut a lot better because I didn't even know that Doug Bradley was even in the film because his voice was different in the theatrical. And I really do think that the theatrical really focused on David Cronenberg's character rather than Boone, And the director's cut switched that to more being Boone's character. And you could tell that with the alternate ending, because in the original theatrical, you see basically the doctor coming back to life. And in the director's cut, it's different.
Well, yeah, because you have the crazy-ass priest who got scorned. Yeah, he got scorned basically by the monsters. And so then he pretty much resurrects our crazy doctor.
Yeah.
David Cronenberg's character.
He had a name in the book, but he didn't have a name in the movie. Andrew, was it Zipperhead or Zipperface?
Yeah, something like Zipperface.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But the theatrical, I do remember it focusing a lot more on his character, even in the trailers. Even in the trailers, it was more focused on him than Boone's character. But I can definitely see that not appreciating it quite as much when you're younger than when you're older. Scott, what about you, sir?
I was looking forward to it because I had only recently gotten into Clive Barker. I'd heard about him because I'd hear about, like, you know, because I heard of Hellraiser and stuff like that. I don't even think I'd seen Hellraiser yet, in fact, at this point. But I remember going to the public library and getting the Books of Blood. They had, like, all three of them in the one volume, like, with some dude without skin, like, eyeballing you on the cover. And I was reading, you know, like, Stephen King and, you know, John Saul, Dean Koontz, you know, those things, you know. And I immediately open this up and start reading it, like, from the first story on, and I'm like, this dude is working on a whole other level. This is, like, some sick shit that I had never thought of, and it's actually somehow really beautiful. And even though it's disturbing at the same time, it's quite beautiful. So I was really stoked to hear about Nightbreed happening. It was supposed to come out in summer of 89. I was not reading Fangoria at the time. I was reading Premiere Magazine. And they didn't go into great detail. They just briefly said in their summer movie preview, it's about an army of monsters. because it just had a blurb there. And then of course I didn't see it come out, and as soon as I saw the ads, I'm like, oh, I immediately got the feeling that 20th Century Fox is fucking this up. They don't know what to do with this movie. I immediately got that feeling because if you look at the original TV spots or anything for Nightbreed, they made it look like a slasher film. I don't even think they mentioned monsters in the ad. So like, if people went to see the movie, they must have been like, what the hell? And so when I finally saw the movie, and finally on VHS, I had to see it. Because people were cooler in Andrew's neighborhood. You couldn't get into an R-rated movie to save your life in my neighborhood. I saw the movie and it immediately became one of my favorite movies. It was one of those movies that I used to, like, bring over, like, all the sheltered kids from private school and say, like, no, I got a new one for you. You got to see this.
And, like, another corrupting movie.
Another corrupting movie where I get to see it, and they all loved it and everything like that. The pastor's kid really laughed nervously. The pastor's kid really loved these movies, but he laughed really nervously and looked at me as when I cheered at the moment where Craig Sheffer goes, we don't like priests here. He's like, my dang on. You know, but it was like, so I mean, I loved it immediately because I was telling everybody, like, guys, you've never seen anything like this. It's about a bunch of monsters, an army of monsters, and they're the good guys. Like, they said, well, who are the bad guys? I said, you are. I am. We are. All of us. We're the bad guys. And I was like, what? And so like, they loved it and everything. And then, of course, I finally got to see the director's cut a couple months ago. And it's like Cole said. I wanted to make sure I have credit to the right people. So like Cole said, all those problems in the original are still there.
Mm-hmm.
He is absolutely right about that, and yet it does feel like a more complete work.
Yeah.
The final battle goes on a lot longer, and it becomes a much more epic struggle. I still say it's not the perfect movie that probably Barker intended.
Yeah.
But I think it's as close as we are ever going to get. And I think it's a great movie. I think it's a fantastic movie that shows the beauty of monsters and sometimes the cruelty of the straight world, which is humanity. Because, yeah. I mean, basically, it's, I mean, when there's like the straight world of humanity, I mean, the, when the monsters are like this, those are the freaks, aren't they? They're the freaks. They're the people who are, who look different, who act different. This being a Clive Barker work, maybe there's quite a bit about sexuality and how that.
No.
And prejudices against, you know, gay, transgendered people, everything like that.
There was none of that in here.
Believe it or not, I think Clive Barker touches on that sometimes. Yes.
Really?
And,
the whole showing your true self in order to actually be accepted. Yeah.
Right. It's the thing. It's like all that, you know, it's all that repression, it's all that conservatism, it's all that molding yourself into be like everybody else, and all the cruelty that happens, because when you do that, then you're going to ostracize some of the most amazing people around you. Yeah. And I think that that was like all those themes really have always appealed to me about this film.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on. I will agree. When I first saw it, I didn't quite follow it. I mean, I was 15 at the time. So, you know, watching it as a 15-year-old, I thought it was, you know, I liked the monster girls, I will admit. Yeah, I was.
I still do.
I still like the monster girls.
Yeah. I will say that.
It is grotesquely beautiful, and I really didn't appreciate it till I watched it later, older, appreciate it properly until I was, got older for me. Because when I first saw it too, I was like, what's going on? I watched it for the monsters because I wanted to see the monsters. And what's interesting is part of the theology in here, they have about the purging of the monsters. Now, any of my geek friends in here who've played D&D, didn't they have something similar like that in history in Dungeons and Dragons about a purge of monsters? It felt very similar to something we had heard before, or what, am I off on that? Anybody remember that at all or played Dungeons and Dragons?
I did, but you know what? I was so young when I got into Dungeons and Dragons that I don't think I really paid attention to the mythology.
So, let's go into our main character first, Mr. Boone. We pick up in this movie, he's been seeing this the psychiatrist, which it must have been the guy, he was getting pro bono work or something, because one look at David Cronenberg and I'm like, no, I don't want him.
You don't want that dude messing around your brain.
He's good at it, though. He's good at it.
Well, yes, with a scalpel, but...
but Boone is our good-looking lead guy, and his character really isn't too bright, is he?
No, he's dumb as a... I heard a phrase from an old friend of mine, dumb as a bag of hair, and I'd say that.
I mean, he really doesn't get smarter throughout the film either, does he?
No. He kind of gets jerked around in the movie. He's kind of more like a cipher more than anything else.
Isn't he more of a puppet? Would you say, Paul, that our Boone is more of a puppet amongst both sides?
It is, but if you think about it, that's his destiny. He's destined to follow the path of being a puppet. So it didn't bother me at all. It actually made his character interesting to me, anyways, that he had to be this person, and everything he did, everything that all the actions that he took led up to that, even though I honestly didn't think that he cared whether or not they all survived or not, but that's just me, I guess.
Now, Andrew, you said you were a big fan of the book. Was Boone kind of that clueless in the book?
Yeah, he's just – Clive Barker writes these sexy dudes, you know what I'm saying? He's a super gay gentleman, and a lot of time it's just his idealized fellas, you know what I'm saying? They're just there's nothing wrong with that at all. You know, it's not that he doesn't have depth for the human character. It's just he's all about the monsters, you know? So he's, you know, yeah, the writing's going to come up short for the human. because you know, and Cypher is a good word for it. Aaron Boone is just, and you can see it in the movie version too. You know, there's he's in his tidy whities, and that's Dr. Clive at work.
Yeah.
time to operate, baby.
Well, that's the thing with Boone, and well, not only that, but he gets shortchanged as a monster form, doesn't he, Cole? Wouldn't you say that his monster form is probably, out of everybody there, is probably the lamest monster form?
Yeah, I think that was probably a decision to keep Craig Sheffer in somewhat recognizable form. That may have been a decision above Clive, I don't know, but I imagine that was the logic behind it. I do think that when I watch it, but I also am a Craig Sheffer fan. Mm-hmm. I that's a weird thing to say, but yeah, I am. I think is one of the great underappreciated 80s teen movies, actually. I love that. Christopher Kane directed that, and I think that's a great S.E. Hinton adaptation, and I watched that, and ever since I've kind of watched what Craig Sheffer does, and his career is deeper, kind of, you know, gone not such a great direction, but
I think
I don't think Boone is any worse than any 80s hero in any 80s horror movie. I mean, he's Craig Sheffer's doing what he can with the role, and everything everybody has said is right, but this is a movie that values the monsters, and he's the bridge, you know, sort of between the humans and the monsters, so it's not like he can change into some completely horrible thing and the audience still, you know, attached to him. But I'm being all technical. If I was a director, I would have done the same thing. I wouldn't have had him, you know, become Brundlefly in the second act.
Well, you can't have him, like, you know, walking around with like three boobs on his head, you know, and I mean, 20th Century Fox has given him a hard enough time already. Just to make sure, because I think you cut out for just a second there when you were giving the name of that movie. Cole, and I want to make sure that everybody got it. You were talking about that. That was then, this is now, right?
That was then, this is now. Yeah, it's one of my favorite movies of the 80s. It's Christopher Kane directed that. He's a terrific director. I mean, he's a pop director, but he had his time when he was good. And
yeah.
Greg Sheffer and Emilio Estevez are great in that movie. I really do. I think their chemistry is phenomenal. I think Craig Sheffer, given a different road, maybe could have been one of our terrific actors.
He was in Fire in the Sky, a really cool alien movie. Sleep With Me with Jeremy Piven, really funny movie.
That was a great movie. Also, he was the villain. Oh, don't forget, he was the real dickhead in Some Kind of Wonderful. So
yeah, he's a decent actor, and in this role though, he does shine when he gets a chance to. I mean, he does, I think. But he doesn't seem to get a huge amount of opportunity with the way his role is written.
He does look like he loves that blood, though, don't you think? Into that, for sure.
God, did it seem like he loved the blood more than his girlfriend?
Just a bit.
I think there was more chemistry between... Well, yeah, I know he's supposed to, but there still seemed to be more chemistry between...
Yeah, no kidding, between him and Ann Bobby.
It's about being gay, you guys. Stories are about being gay.
Yes.
You guys got to know this by now, man.
And that was something... I mean, I think a lot of younger... Again, I think I've said this before on the show about lots of things, but... I mean, that's something a lot of people today who are like these millennials and stuff might be surprised by that. No, guys, even 25 years ago, you would not be allowed to have a protagonist in a movie or even somebody that was not written as some sort of stereotype and just say, yeah, it's about him being gay. You couldn't say it back then. They didn't say it back then. There were no parts in major studio films for gay protagonists. And even for the first few years when there finally was, it was like they were always dying of AIDS or something like that. It really wasn't until, it's true, it wasn't really until like the middle to mid-90s, I'd say, that it really changed. And so you had to use all this symbolic, you know, stuff about, you know, Well, the monsters is really where he belongs, you know.
Okay, well, let's dig in this, then. If we're talking about Clive and we're talking about Nightbreed, I did not expect our conversation about this film to go this direction. But
no, you didn't.
Since we are there, because I'm not too big of a follower of Clive Barker. I mean, I knew he was homosexual and everything, but the subtext in this film, I didn't catch it till now you mention it. So many
people fall
into place in this film. It isn't just about him being gay. He's actually bi, but not only that, is the monsters actually the metaphor for alternative lifestyles, not just gay or lesbian, but let's go into transsexual and sadomasochism.
Yeah.
And,
yes,
absolutely.
All of that. Yes, all the different... Yep. All the different ways that are not kind of in that, like, waspy, you know, Leave It to Beaver, good morning, it's morning in America, 1980s, you know, white, suburban, straight-laced thing. Anything that's like that, anybody who outwardly exhibits behavior that is not conducive to that and does it proudly.
Wow.
That's the thing, is that even though these people had to hide, they had to hide who they were. They were living in terror of the Morning in America people. And I'm just so sorry if I'm offending people. That's how I see them, the Morning in America people. They were hiding in terror from them. But you know what? Amongst themselves, they could be free. They could be proud to be who they were. And it's that fight against repression of homosexuality, BDSM, anything, all that, you know, any kind of thing that does not fit that mold. Absolutely.
I mean, here's the Next Generation reference for you. Timba, his eyes open, literally talking to you guys right now. I am looking at this film in a completely different light.
Hey, Mark, there's a line where the lady goes, man, when you dream, you wish you could be us, you know, like, and what you envy, you destroy.
Well, everything in this
that
now.
Says
that
everything
is just,
right there.
That is just falling into place. I don't know how I picked, you know, I picked a little bit of it. But now that you're saying this and listening to all you wonderfully brilliant people on this, I'm thinking to myself, like, oh, my God, this is all clicking down to them referring to them as naturals versus I'm like, wow, you know, and they can only come out at night because similar to that lifestyle, those people, that lifestyle is usually associated with evening, with night activities, with.
Or just hiding, or just being where they can be safe.
Or being hiding, or hiding. Or
just hiding because they have to hide in the shadows, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and now that you guys mentioned this, holy crap. Well, because then it all evens out when we visit these town folks, because eventually things start falling apart. We've got Psycho Doctor going around killing people and then blaming it on Boone. Boone's discovering his destiny. And, of course, the rednecks folks get involved. I mentioned this to Dawn. I'm like, wow. I'm, like, watching this going, man, Clive really's got something against the rednecks because, oh, my God, these guys.
As well he should.
he's got a hate on for the right extreme.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, because, I mean, Andrew, the scene where they're getting the posse together, where they go through the weapons. I'm like, could he be parroting right-wing extremists any further with those scenes?
No, it's hey, I'm right here in Georgia, pal. they do that shit when watch the power go out in the storm.
Yeah,
somewhere that's happening.
Really?
And they're all gonna go into Target with him.
Oh,
we picked the wrong name for this store.
you got a lot of open carries out there.
I've never seen it because I run the fuck away.
Yeah, I have every single friend I have down here. Just about has a conceal weapons permit to have a gun on them at all times, and they always know that. Always keep it out of sight of me because he's the. Scott's the wimpy liberal guy from up north. He doesn't like guns at all. I get nervous around him.
I'm always afraid they'd kill me because they can smell Midian on me, I'm sure.
He's a natural bang.
Well, since we're on our discussion of the right-wing folks, Paul, what was your thoughts on the police captain?
Oh, my God.
By Charles Hayne?
He was the first time we were introduced with him to him, he's beating the crap out of Boone, and it's just, I was not thinking the captain. Am I thinking the right person?
I loved the
news interview that he does, or the press conference. He's sitting there and he's answering away, and then suddenly his deputy comes over and whispers him, is like, you know, the guy's dead. and he's like, he just gets up. Like, he gets up, puts on his glasses, and he walks away. Just leaves everybody there because he doesn't care. It's all about himself. It's just an interesting character.
Well, he's a wild character, and I didn't remember an original theatrical cut. He didn't survive that battle first off, did he? I mean, I don't remember the scene where he was all burnt up and approaching the priest at all. Was that in the theatrical cut or
that
not?
That scene is not in there, but I don't remember what happened to him. I mean, I haven't seen the theatrical in a couple of years, so
yeah.
I'm not sure how he went out.
I didn't remember. Okay, so that wasn't just me. That seemed like an additional part that he was.
That's an added scene.
When he showed up at the end saying, oh, let's go after them all and you know, joining with the priest. We're going to go kill, you know, and then the priest
says no.
Thing. And he says no. But
I love that because with Cronenberg's character dead, you have an ending. The film sort of completes itself. You know, it doesn't begin this weird. I mean, where were they going to go with two? You know, Cronenberg alive as a zombie? I mean, what a stupid thing to do.
I think he would have gone in a weird direction of himself. It's one of those things we'll never know because he's just wacky. You know what? I shouldn't say that because hasn't he done a series of Nightbreed comics over the years? Maybe
yes,
I don't know.
There was Nightbreed, and there was Nightbreed versus Hellraiser also.
And there's a Nightbreed comic that's being printed right now. So I mean, I don't know if that story continues or if it's different stories about the mythology or what. I have not looked at them, so I shouldn't say.
So did the comics continue with Cronenberg alive, or did it follow more of the director's cut, Andrew? Do you know?
I don't know.
Oh, God, I was like 14 years old.
I just didn't know. You mentioned that. I didn't know if you had read them or not. So we got our extreme rednecks in here. We've got our subtext basically pulling a Nightmare on Elm Street 2 here.
Let's not forget the Cronenberg character.
And then the Cronenberg
Who is the straight guy? He's a paragon of the community. He's a psychiatrist and he does all these things. But he's the most psychotic, murderous person, and it takes him no effort at all to just say, "Oh, he did it. Look at him."
Yeah.
and he'd been using Boone apparently since he was a child to get to milk that information from him. So he had no conscience whatsoever to exploit a child to go through this whole thing to exploit a child of everything.
They don't come out and say it. I think there was also probably a lot of a different abuse when he was a child. Don, I'm glad you brought that up.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, I think that you could make parallels to that. And, of course, why does he do all this in the shadows? I think that it's a sense of shame. I think it's a sense of shame that whole thing, what you don't understand, you destroy. He wants to – I mean, Cronenberg doesn't want to become one of them. He wants to eradicate these people because maybe he can eradicate the ugliness in himself. I mean, there's like a lot of shit going on in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
That's why I love it. There's like all this stuff going on right beneath the surface of this movie.
Well, there is. There's a whole lot of stuff going on, and then we can go into their religion as well for Midian. With Boone being the savior and destroyer of their world, Cole, did you get a little bit of religious tones with that as well?
Yeah, I did.
I'm not gonna go so far as say Christ moments, but
there's definitely that is there. That is there. Although, again, you know, I tend to bypass that stuff just because sure. It's always there. It's like, it seems like that's always there. So, I mean, I do acknowledge it, and I perceive it and I watch it, but for better or worse, it's whether or not it adds to the story at all. And this just sort of bypass it. I mean, right. There were references there, but it didn't really play into, I mean, it wasn't like Matrix Revolutions. I mean, Craig Sheffer didn't like go back and do his Christ pose.
Well, I would also say Moses. Midian's from the Old Testament. Midian. Now, basically, the deal is that Moses actually kills a guy.
Right.
And he's a nice. He's actually really well respected. He's like nobility, and he actually kills a guy for apparently no reason other than it's like a hate crime. He doesn't like the type of guy he is.
Yeah.
And he goes into exile in Midian for 40 years, and then he gets a vision from a voice in a burning bush. The God, Cabal, what have you, and then comes out to lead afterwards.
Sure.
There is a burning bush in this film.
There you go.
I mean, that's what happens here.
I'm admittedly out of my element. I don't.
I actually wish I was out of my element. I know too. I had a lot of upbringing in that crap.
so is there the Moses undertones in there, Paul, or overtones?
Yes. Well, in fact, there's one. The Lindsay character, the Doug Bradley character, he has actually referred to. At one moment in the film, it jokingly, as Moses, because he's this old guy.
Yes, you're right.
But sort of like the caretaker.
I didn't catch that. It's good.
Yeah, so I mean, this movie has a lot going on that I didn't realize till some of it while we were talking right now about this film. Going not quite so in-depth, I will say when this film came out, it surprised me for the amount of monsters, practical effects, Dawn mentioned, I believe, about the practical effects in here. I loved the design of the monsters. Paul, what did you think of the design of these monsters?
The best thing was the fact that three of the Cenobites are in this film. The male ones, anyway. So you got Butterball, you got Chatterbox, and then, of course, you got Pinhead. And they're all back in there. But besides that, I mean, the makeup work was, it stands up. It's great. You can, I watched it 25 years later and the makeup looks wonderful. Mm-hmm. And it's not, they've got the full body ones, but they also have just the face makeups. And I think just the simple face makeups were just as beautiful, if not better than the full bodies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I definitely appreciated the makeup that they did in there. And it just, and then everyone was unique, which is
right.
Can I add something about what you were asking about the Boone character not having the full
good
treatment? Mm-hmm. If you look at the Nightbreed, the Tribes of the Moon, each of them has a reflection. Their outer appearance was a reflection of what they were inside.
Sure.
And I think the reason why Boone had that type of writing was that he was about arcane mystery, and the fact that his path was already written for him, and it kind of just adds to that element. And so all the other Nightbreeds, and that's why they're all individual. You didn't see them being the same. I just thought that added to that whole layer. Sure.
Mm-hmm. Oh wow, that's great.
That is. That's wow. You just.
I like that. I like the bit about the writing. That's really interesting.
Yeah, you're right. Because he did have the different text on, and then when he went to see. I always get the name screwed up. The big
Baphomet?
Yeah, Baphomet down in the base. He gets a different marking on him when he looks at Baphomet. Is he carrying the consciousness of Baphomet? Or what was that? I didn't quite follow, and I may be just dumb. Andrew?
That's muddled writing, for sure.
What was going on with the Baphomet character?
I don't know. All I know is I was Cabal for Halloween last
year. Nice.
Any of you guys see that picture, man?
I did, yeah.
John, do you know what did you follow, or I couldn't quite follow, was he taking the consciousness of Baphomet, where, because they were down there taking pieces of Baphomet down too,
it looked like. You know, I couldn't quite get if I know at one point he asked for crying out loud, I can't remember the guy's name. I know at one point he asked if Baphomet could be moved, yeah. But then that last time he went down to talk with Baphomet, Baphomet said, "Come and find me," as if the consciousness of Baphomet was escaping out without his physical form,
right,
and needed to be found and put back together. So I, again, like Cole said, it was a little muddled and not quite clear.
Okay. I don't think you could do Baphomet on screen. I mean, that part was the toughest part for me, because, you know, they spent a lot of money on that movie, but they care. But Baphomet in the book, it's just like, it's like God or something. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly.
Like a huge religious figure, and representing that at all, I'm sure it was just a huge, huge undertaking. It was never gonna make sense, man.
Right. Okay, good. So it wasn't just me then. I was trying to figure. I'm like,
no, it's a concept. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's like it's a concept, and mm-hmm. You think about when they try putting God on the screen. You know, it's yeah. Like as Alanis Moore said, is it a mannequin painted black with some Christmas lights on it? You know?
Yeah.
I think it's Alanis Morissette.
I like Christmas. In a way, Andrew is very much correct on that, because, I mean, Baphomet tells Cabal at this time, go find me, go out and lead the people and find me. And that's him saying, find God in yourself, you know, out there. Don't try to hide yourself. Go out there, find God.
Which means they may just drift for a while until he finally just gets an inkling going, we're going to camp here.
Mm-hmm.
And
come down with two tablets.
And of course,
what do you know? God was in this barn.
And of course, maybe it's a manger. And of course, Baphomet is, of course, a deity often associated with the occult. So,
yeah.
You know, so again, that is kind of like that, more that flip side about like, sorry, white people, boom. don't get your Jerry Falwell out of here. You know, that kind of thing.
What were you going to say, Cole?
I was going to say one of the most interesting things about writing fantasy and horror I found is you run the risk of over or under explaining your mythology. Mm-hmm. And the line between over or under explaining your own mythology for your own characters is so fine. I mean, you run the risk of it at any moment. And something like a Baphomet, I imagine, bringing to screen. I haven't read the book, but I've read Weave World, which
is
incredible.
It's awesome.
And yeah. I've been hearing about them trying to bring this to life. And I just think there's no way when this guy opens his coat, even with CGI, anything you do would be a cheat. So maybe this is that way. But I still feel like Barker has never, as a screenwriter, I don't know if this is a directorial fault, but his screenplays short you on explaining the mythology. And I feel the same way about Hellraiser, which I've read. I've read his, you know, The Hellbound Heart. And just a little bit more of that, just a little bit more of the explanation via dialogue would have gone a long way. And it would have for this film, too.
Yeah.
I love this film. And I don't throw around the term masterpiece easily. I mean, I watch probably 20 new movies a week. I know that seems like not many to some of you, and some of you may be like, well, get a life. But to me, it's a lot.
It's a really good number, I think.
And, I think... Clive Barker's weakness in his screenwriting is that he could bring a little bit more of that backstory up to the front in the dialogue. That would have helped.
I think what he tries to do, because, you know, Clive is a visual artist, an incredible painter, and so there's so much is in his head that he thinks that, like, well, all right, in the book, it's in the prose, but on screen, I've got to be visual. You know, I can't just sit there and have it all be exposition. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's where it's always tripped up. I mean, Candyman's probably the best movie ever made from one of his stories. Yeah, he didn't direct that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, see, that's the feeling I ever got from Clive Barker, because, you know, Hellraiser as well. I always felt like there was more there, and it was cut, or that maybe he's writing it thinking, oh, they'll know what I mean.
He gets hooked up on the visuals, Max. Hellraiser is a visually exciting movie.
Oh, visual.
Nightbreed is too. You kind of gotta go. Well, if you want Mo, go see the book. Get the video.
Yeah, that's true. We talk about the visuals, but one of the things that sticks out with me, and it's not just because I'm a big Danny Elfman fan, but was the music for Nightbreed. I really think the music helped, at least in the opening, set the tone of this film and really gives you into the mood of what type of movie you're watching. And even throughout, the score for this, I think, is pretty good. I don't know. What are your guys' thoughts on the score? I mean, not just because I'm a Danny Elfman fan, but I think it's a decent score, especially for the type of film it is.
I think it's one of his best.
Yeah, it's huge, man. I feel like it fills in the gaps that just couldn't be done with technology, or, you know, their limitations with the script. I think that's what fills in those holes and just makes the movie just be, like, you know, epic love story that it is. You know?
Yeah, it is an epic love story and a freeing of oneself and discovery of oneself. So many themes, as everybody's touched on here. I think we'll wrap up Nightbreed real quick. I just want to know from everybody here real quick, favorite monster out of the breed. Cole, you go first. Who is your favorite monster?
Gosh. I like... I'm completely drawing a blank. It's the...
Oh, the tiger guy.
Yeah.
Pelequin.
Yeah. Yes, thank you. Thank you.
The tiger dude, yeah.
He's just in terms of being a monster's monster, he's amazing. He sets the tone for the rest of the movie, man.
He's the guy.
The movie sort of really starts. You feel like, okay, let's do it.
He has my favorite line in the movie. He has that line that everything is true. God's an astronaut. Oz is over the rainbow. And it is where the monsters live. What a great line! Oh, my God!
That's the best line in the movie.
It is. It is the best line in the movie, and the way he delivers it is perfect. And with his makeup and everything, you're just like, that scene does give you little chills right there, just the way he says it, and he says it so matter-of-factly, too. It's not like he says it overly dramatic or anything. He's just the stories you heard are correct.
There is no Santa Claus.
Yeah. You know. Don, what about you? A favorite monster out of Midian? If you had to pick one.
Okay, out of Midian. I, of course, loved the makeup of... the character, the Shunasazi, the porcupine woman.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, definite. Great makeup. And the way she acts, too, the actress playing her.
Very, very fluid movements.
And she put a few holes in your damn face.
She deadly as well, yeah. And, excellent point. And actually, I think they were kind of a couple. So interesting that they were back-to-back picks for you guys, because I think those two were a couple, weren't they? Or it kind of implied a little.
I think it implied it. I'm not sure.
I know they were at least very friendly with one another. At least that's the way it seems. So two great picks so far. Andrew, what about you? If you had to pick a monster...
I was always a narcissist guy myself.
Yeah.
He was the guy the 13-year-old boy would gravitate to. You know, he's a wise ass, you know, and he's he had that awesome scene that they did great in the movie. He was like, "I'm gonna show you my true face." He's just like, "You're like, this guy's gonna rip his damn face off." But yeah, there's one part in the movie where he says, "No time for hoochie coochie." The line in the book is, "No time for fucky fucky."
He was a great character. He was like a mature version of the hitchhiker from Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
But man, he was also really he was pretty flirty with everyone. You know
he was. He was. I mean, he
like popping that gum, you know.
he was really ambiguous, and just whatever floated his boat at the moment seemed to...
Yeah, you might run into him at a bar, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
Clive probably did, actually.
I got the feeling that he was very... he was actually probably a little more sexually predatory, than a lot of the other people in the
he was not above necrophilia, so
yeah,
you know,
kind of gross, you know. Hey, the flowers are already there.
Yeah. Paul, what about you, sir? Favorite Midian monster?
Rachel, because she was a smoking hot kisser.
Nice. Nice, yeah. Her power was cool too. That was just cool.
Awesome.
Excellent choice, Paul. What about you, sir?
You just said Paul.
I mean, I did that again. Scott, sorry.
Hi.
Hi. How are you?
Yeah. What Andrew said. Narciss. Is that how you pronounce it? Narciss.
I don't know.
I don't know. Narciss. Narcissi.
Narcissi.
Narcissi. I like that. Dude.
Nerfball. I don't know. But yeah, I liked him a lot. You know, and I was just thinking about this just now because, though I most recently watched Night Verdict a couple months ago, I did recently revisit one of my favorite movies that I watch at least once a year this week, The Ninth Configuration, which everybody should see. And the guy that I'm referring to in this movie is actually a nice guy, but he is kind of very much very out in your face and crazy and messing with people. And so it reminds me of the Scott Wilson character a little bit in Ninth Configuration, just the way he kind of throws himself around and like kind of gets under the doctor's skin in the Ninth Configuration and everything. And that, I mean, you basically add a little perversion and some knife play, and you've got this guy.
and for me, it's a toss up because I did like all the creatures in here: Porcupine Lady, the Tiger Guy. But I gotta go with Mac the Knight, Half Moon Head. I forgot his name, but.
Mac the Knight. Oh my god!
I'm sorry. Every time
it looks like Jay Leno, right? Like, yeah.
No, man, Mac the Knight. Oh, you have no idea how much I just love that you just referenced that. Oh my god!
He looks like Mac
the Knight. He does. When I saw him when I was a kid, and then when they came out with Mac the Knight, I could not watch the movie again without thinking McDonald's.
Oh my god! I want to see that guy playing piano on a giant hamburger.
But I really like that guy. I don't know what it is, but I like this character because, you know, he's sitting there and he's like, no, this guy's not meat, dude. Don't eat him, man. You know, he's just like this. He, outside of the way he looks, he's like one of the more normal Midian characters. That, you know, he doesn't really have a really wild personality. He doesn't have, outside of the shape of his head, he's actually just kind of, you know, a normal guy type of thing. He's like, oh, you know, we got rules here, man.
He was cool. Kinski. He was very cool.
That's who he is. And that's what, thank you, Paul. Kinski. That's great pronunciation there, especially with my list.
His last name is Leno.
Leno. He did remind me a little too, but so great insight there on Nightbreed, folks. I bet you haven't looked at that movie the same way ever again. I know I won't now, thanks to our lovely crew members here.
Well, now I'm gonna look at Kinski as Mac tonight. So fantastic.
Thank you so much for listening to part one of our two-part special for our 25th anniversary series of episodes. Make sure you check out part two where we discuss Frankenhooker, also celebrating its 25th anniversary. You can also check out the older episodes of The Spoiler Room on specialmarkproductions.com, as well as iTunes and Stitcher Smart Radio.